on the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The clergy sex abuse scandal continues to cause anger, sadness, and upheaval in the church in the United States. And since our last Register Radio, Pope Francis has revised the catechism in the text regarding capital punishment. This week, we talk about the latest teaching on the death penalty and how Catholics should respond with EWTN's Colin Donovan. We also continue our coverage of the ongoing scandal of sex abuse brought to the limelight by the disturbing revelations around Theodore McCarrick. How might troubled Catholics respond to this moment in our church? Ralph Martin, the evangelist and theologian, has some suggestions. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio. I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen in Washington, D.C. He's the Register's senior editor and co-host for this show. Matthew, welcome.
Good to be with you, as always.
So, Matthew, you know, Catholics are deeply troubled by all that is going on regarding former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, now Archbishop Theodore McCarrick. You know, we're going to be talking to Ralph Martin about his letter to troubled Catholics. But, you know, in the midst of all of this, we were kind of surprised by the death penalty teaching kind of falling on our laps a couple Thursdays ago.
Well, Pope Francis, as is his wont to do, surprised all of us. We're going to be talking about how this came about, but certainly a rather startling revision to, I think it's paragraph 2267 in the Catechism. So any of our listeners, if you have the Catechism handy, turn to that.
That's right. That's right. And I am joined in the Birmingham studio with EWTN's head of the theology department, and he's a Register contributor as well, Colin Donovan. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, Jeanette.
So you've written something for the Register, which we haven't published yet. Right. It's going to be published in the next print edition a couple of weeks from now, that we're going to be doing a symposium on the death penalty. But you've written something that really outlines that this isn't necessarily something new for the Church, this teaching, that there's some continuity here that needs to be kept mm-hmm. in people's minds, the history behind it. But there are still some questions as well that the Holy See needs to answer. So before I actually get into the details of what you've written, I think it's important to answer the question that we've been hearing a lot. So the Church has changed the teaching? What do you say to that claim, Colin?
Well, some pretty good arguments are being made that there's something going on here, even in the explanations being given by the Holy See. They mm-hmm. talk about doctrinal development. And we certainly saw the roots and the seeds of that, particularly in John Paul II and the Gospel of Life. But as far as changing the teaching, I think what troubles a lot of people is this, the idea that, well, the Church has always defended the essential goodness and justice of paying for a capital crime with one's life, that there is a justice means a life for a life. And, of course, this was the law of the Old Covenant as right. well that God promulgated. And this had a very strong, powerful effect on teaching this. And even in the natural world among non-believers, we see that the Greek philosophers arrived at this conclusion as well, that justice for capital crimes would mean taking a life. So that's something that has been in the Church, and so I think people are a little bit shocked to hear the Pope say that it's inadmissible, as the new language says.
Right.
But it notably doesn't say intrinsically evil, which
right.
is the normal way of categorizing in moral theology. Something whose moral object, in other words, the thing done, not whether your intention is good or bad, that can make a good thing evil, not whether the circumstances are good or bad, that can make a good thing evil, but whether the thing is evil in and of itself and
right.
always in every possible circumstance. And he doesn't seem to say that. He says it's inadmissible. And so you mentioned the history there, and I think that's where we can get some comfort in the fact that in the early Church, despite an appreciation of the Old Testament, despite the the wisdom of the philosophers being out and about in the Mediterranean basin, that nonetheless the church chose not to exercise capital punishment itself. Christians didn't take positions in the army, in the legions. Remember Christ's admonition to the centurion to basically be honest and all of that, but not cruel and so on. And so a soldier who defended himself against immediate attack could act justly, but the church didn't want people in positions of authority where they had to decide capital cases and then order them carried out,
right,
typically with the with their own sword. So this was a prohibition early on, and I think it was a circumstantial prohibition, not a declaration that is intrinsically evil, because that injustice was so built into the Roman system. You know, I forget which movie it is, but in one of the biblical movies you watch at Christmas time or Easter, they show the 1,000 crosses that the Romans put up when they first invaded the land to kill off all those who opposed them. Because for them, violence was a normal way to exert their power, sure, and to change the hearts and the minds of people. And so the church didn't want to flatter that position, and so it stepped back from it. And it also was following the example of Jesus, who's, you know, his view was that, well, if you're struck on the right cheek, turn the left. And so this was the perspective. After the empire was Christianized, after the Edict of Milan in 313, when Constantine, first of all, he prohibited capital punishment, and then it slowly crept back in. And by the latter part of that 4th century, the fathers were writing about the justice of the act and so on, as it began to be realized that, okay, now that we're in charge, now that we have to defend people, we have to defend, we have to defend the state, there can be just reasons, but we at least have Christians who will be, will hopefully have a just motive and, sure, do it in just circumstances. I think the operative question today with this revision is, has the Pope foreseen, as I believe John Paul II already did, that the culture of death is so rampant that the only witness that can possibly change that is the witness of not availing ourselves of the kinds of self-defenses which may be justified, but on the other hand, whether intentionally or not, continue to foster an attitude and view towards human life which is no longer acceptable and which has brought great harm to the 20th century, right, and to the 21st century.
So in other words, what you're saying, it's a radical witness to human dignity.
I believe so. I believe that what's what we're called to do. And I think it also means that the church will recognizes the climb that people will have to get there.
Sure.
Without bad will at all, to acknowledge, we're thinking of the 9/11 attacks, and who would have argued on 9/12 that if we catch these guys, death should not, shouldn't be their punishment. So I think it's a long way, and I think the church will slowly inculcate this more and more, as John Paul and Benedict already had.
Right.
But perhaps now with a little more force, a little more diplomatic force, it's mentioned in I believe it was the letter to the bishops, to get this on the world stage more and to push it a little bit more. But it then becomes incumbent upon governments to fulfill the other half of that.
Right.
If you want it to be truly rare, if non-existent.
Which then, was John Paul's teaching in the
which
catechism.
Which was the one that was changed, the teaching that was changed. If you want that, and to move from rare to non-existent,
right,
then you have to be able to secure the safety of the society, of the guards who work with prisoners who have killed. And I think, as we all know, our prison situations are really bad in some places.
Right.
And so there's a long road ahead. It's not like tomorrow this is going to get turned off and everything will be fine.
Right. Matthew, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, and Colin, talk about the way that this revision of the Catechism's language can help people form their consciences under all of the circumstances that you've been describing.
Sure. Yeah, and I think the one that John Paul II used in Evangelium Vitae, I believe it's in like paragraphs 55 and 56, where he addresses capital punishment as a kind of self-defense, okay? But he talked a great deal about the unique and unrepeatable gift of the human person. This is a 20th century language. It's the language of personalism. You find it, you know, beginning in the 20th century when, instead of speaking categorically of human nature and so on, philosophers and theologians began to look at the significance of the person. After all, within the Holy Trinity, there you have three persons, and that's what we focus on. It's a divine nature, but there are these three persons. And so to look only at human nature was not considered enough beginning about 100 years ago. So we start to look more and more at the importance of the person. The Second Vatican Council did. We no longer call Protestants heretics. We no longer call the Orthodox schismatics. We give more weight to their subjective conscience, even if it's objectively an error. And so we have greater respect for the individual and where they're at and so on and so forth. I think this points to that when he says it's about the dignity of the person and not about human nature per se. And I think that's moving it from the question of natural justice to the Christian ambit and the idea that everyone, even the criminal, the enemy, the poor, the person you don't know, is truly a unique and unrepeatable gift. And when they're standing before you, even if they're the criminal who has done something terribly evil, you shouldn't be the one to take their life away and their opportunity of repentance. So I think they've got a bit of a hill to climb in explaining why they're saying it's intrinsically evil circumstantially today, but not intrinsically evil in the object, and balancing the rights of the safety of the community. So I think they've got a slog to get this to the point where people say, yeah, I can accept that without any difficulty.
Right. I have to ask a question, and we're really out of time, but it's really important, so I'm willing to go over for this. But, you know, you've said we've got a ways to go, and there are natural questions, this question of where are the rights of the state, because the Congregation for Doctrine of Faith even acknowledges that the state has a right. So when they issued this letter that accompanied the change of the text, they say the state has a right to defend its people for justice and also for protection. So how does that fit with an inadmissible, you know, the rule that it is inadmissible? So that's a natural question. But a very natural question, too, is, as you're acknowledging, we're not all there yet. You know, we even as societies, some societies, maybe in first world countries we are, but in other societies, they're not quite there yet to be able to embrace this.
Right.
What is a Catholic to do? I mean, in our own hearts and minds, of course, this is part of the catechism now.
It is.
What must we do?
Well, there's a great document which merits everybody reading, put out by Cardinal Ratzinger in 1990 as prefect of the CDF, called On the Ecclesial Vocation of a Theologian. And there he deals with the issue of the difference between dissent, where you're sort of rapidly going at the church and rejecting, say, Humanae Vitae in its entirety or whatever, whatever it is, and having some doubts and questions and how you should deal with that. Respecting what the church is teaching, on the other hand, also giving due credit to the church and her authority and her right to teach us and to even to require certain things of us. And when you do that, then you will put prayer and reflection and study at the center of your approach and not just simply be reactive. Oh, another thing I don't like from Rome or from my bishop or whatever. You'll be more respectful. You'll be more perhaps thinking and prayerful about, okay, how am I going to inculcate this idea?
Absolutely. Well, Colin, thank you so much for joining us for this important discussion, and we look forward to sharing with our readers your commentary on the subject. Joan Desmond also wrote on this subject a reported story called Weighing the Church's Teaching
great,
on Capital,
great article, by
capital
the way.
Punishment. So I would advise our readers to find that article. In it, Jerry Bradley, a professor at Notre Dame, really had an important point to make about the fact that this teaching, while it is a change, this is nothing like changing teaching on contraception. This is right. a development. It is natural, and there are very, very solid explanations for what Pope Francis is trying to do here, even if we have questions. This is right. nothing like changing contraception.
No, and Cardinal Ratzinger makes the point in that document I mentioned that the church sometimes argumentation can fail. We still have to look to the authority and the and confidence in Christ's promises.
So we do hope for more clarity, but we also appreciate where we are now. So thank you very much. When we come back, we talk to Ralph Martin about how Catholics can respond to the latest sex abuse scandal. This is Register Radio.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Tim Staples.
The National Catholic Register gives you the world's news like no other. Only NCR has a stable of writers steeped in good Catholic theology and philosophy to give you the news with proper perspective.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner or call 1-800-421-3230.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and as usual, I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, who is our Senior Editor. And today we are joined by Ralph Martin. He's the President of Renewal Ministries, and he recently published an article at the National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. It was originally published at Renewal Ministries, and he is talking about a topic that is on everyone's mind these days, unfortunately, and that is this crisis that we are still facing of sexual abuse within the church. And the real question for so many of us is, how are we still here, and where do we go from here? And just incredible disappointment at what's happening in the church today. So, Ralph, I'm thankful for what you wrote at the Register. It's titled, Dear Troubled Catholics, A Letter from Ralph Martin on the Crisis. And so thank you for pouring yourself out into this letter. And first of all, I ask, why did you write it?
Well, I've actually been writing about this kind of problem for probably 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
I published a book in the early 80s called A Crisis of Truth, The Undermining of Faith, Morality, and Mission in the Catholic Church. And I had chapters on pastoral passivity, ignoring the problem, moving offenders around, and mainly because I've been getting letters for years from people telling me these terrible things that were going on and how
right.
bishops would ignore them and that type of thing. And so when this happened, I just knew I needed to say something. I addressed it originally just to people who are connected with us at Renewal Ministries and get our newsletter and things like that. But the letter has been so widely spread, I can't believe it. It's
yeah.
just like all over the place, and everybody's posting it on their websites and putting it on Facebook pages. So I just felt like we had just had to call a spade, and the sickness is wide and it's deep, and we've got to get to the bottom of it this time. We just can't kind of cover it up and pretend that it's just an isolated case of Cardinal McCarrick, and it's all over the place. And, you know, all kinds of people are starting to come forward now saying, yeah, you know, I've been sexually harassed too, you know, in my seminary or in my diocese. And, you know, I know the case of a young priest now who went to his bishop who said, look, I'm living with a pastor who's openly homosexual. I can't take it anymore. I'm going to leave the priesthood. The bishop said, you got to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, crazy.
Right. Yeah, and we're hearing this all around. So these aren't isolated situations. They're much more widespread than many admit.
Yeah. So I think that honestly, a lot of people are calling that we need some kind of lay involvement in the solution, some kind of like national lay board that kind of the bishops empowered to really look into this whole thing, because I think it's very, very hard for bishops to police themselves. I think they've made that clear. And so I think we do need some more radical measures like we
Ralph,
had when we were concerned about the abuse of minors. We established the National Review Board that seemed to do a really good job at kind of dealing with that issue.
Yeah, Ralph, I want to read a brief piece from your article where you talk about dear troubled Catholics, and you say, we need to remember that the Catholic Church is indeed founded by Christ, and despite all the problems, has within it the fullness of the means of salvation. Where else can we go, you ask? And the answer, of course, is nowhere. That's an important point to make to Catholics today, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. I mean, there's two things that need to happen. We need to really say this is a serious problem, but at the same time, we need to give hope and encouragement to people saying, look, the Church has had these problems before. You know, read Catherine of Siena. I quoted her in my letter, and it's just, she's describing almost identically what we're going through today with a homosexual scandal that was covered up, you know? And so, yes, I mean, the Catholic Church has been founded by Christ. It's the place where the full means of salvation exists, where Jesus himself is present in a unique and absolutely fantastic, wonderful way in the Eucharist. And there's no place we should even think of going. I would never think of leaving the Catholic Church, and nobody should think of leaving the Catholic Church. But we really got to pray and fast and work for its reform.
And, you know, your letter is based off of so much that you hear, because you're out there, you know, your job is really evangelization. I mean, you're out there with people, and you're listening to people, and you're teaching. You know, this week you've been doing a retreat, and it seems like every week that's what you're doing. So what are you hearing? What are the concerns that are most on people's minds?
Well, I also teach at Sacred Heart Seminary in Detroit, and I had a class this summer, just a few weeks ago, with priests from all over the country. We have a summer STL program. We have 50 priests enrolled into it, and I wasn't planning to bring this whole issue up, but the priest brought it up 2 days before class ended, and they told me that they're actually living in fear.
Mm-hmm.
Their fear of being punished, their fear of being exiled, their fear of being rejected by their fellow priests if they bring these things to the surface, their fear that their bishop won't do anything about it but will punish them. And I was really quite surprised to hear that, you know. And they told me, look, you're a layperson. You can't understand the fear that people live in, that priests live in, and now they got files on us. They can do damage to us, you know, and we know these problems are there, but we're afraid to bring them up. And I said, well, you know, we can't live in fear. You got to get over that. You got to fear God more than human beings. And so what if you get banished to a rural parish? I mean, you need to do the right thing. So we had a really great talk about it, but the priests were telling me that they're fearful, and that's why
right. This
stuff hasn't come up.
Right, and that makes sense. I mean, there is a similarity to the Me Too movement, you know, that has been
yes.
all over the world, the country, that, you know, talks
yes.
a lot about the, you know, of course, it started with the Hollywood entertainment industry. And, of course, they were fearing not being able to progress in their careers. But really,
yes.
I mean,
what you're
describing is so much worse, because not simply is this a livelihood the priest can pick up and go somewhere else, you know, to practice their career.
Yeah.
This is their career.
Right.
Speak to the differences between this and the Me Too movement.
Yeah, and hopefully what we need now is for people to really have the courage to kind of start telling the truth about what they've experienced so that the thing can be cleaned up. And I think it's starting to happen. We actually need some bishops to come forth. Bishop Conley has done it a little bit. Bishop Scharfenberger has done it a little bit where, hey, look, I did hear about this stuff, and I didn't do anything about it, and I really should have, and forgive me, and I'm going to do better, you know? And,
absolutely.
I think we need more bishops and more priests and more seminarians to come forward and to tell us the truth about what they experienced, and they need to ask forgiveness, but it's got to come out, you know? We got to break the code of silence.
Yes. In fact, you know, this week on the Bishop of Metuchen in New Jersey, which is part of the sort of epicenter of where the McCarrick scandal was coming out of, he has spoken out, and he has said, you know, fear of retribution must end for seminarians. So so he seems to be inviting the stories and the problems to come forward, and I think that does need to happen. I have one question that is about what you wrote, and it also seemed to come up with the seminarians, and that was, you know, what about Pope Francis's leadership, and what role must he play in this part with McCarrick, because we haven't heard from him yet.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, it's getting kind of puzzling who his main advisors are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Carl Maradiaga, who they refer to as the Vice Pope, who's head of the Council of Cardinals of Nine, they're supposed to be bringing reform to the church and cleaning up the mess in Rome. His handpicked auxiliary bishop just had to resign a little while ago because of homosexual relationships with seminarians and with men and financial impropriety. The cardinal himself now has charges of financial impropriety. And then the seminaries in his diocese, and the whole number of them, I think you broke the story, right. National Catholic Register, Edward Penton, and that they wrote to him and saying, look, there's a homosexual network in our seminary, and it's got to be cleaned up. And he blamed the National Catholic Register for stirring up trouble and called it gossip and rumor. And, wow, this is pretty scary. I mean, you know, he's one of the most influential people, you know, advising Pope Francis. Well, you know, and then you have Cardinal Marx from Germany, who is really out there leading the charge to kind of loosen up sexual morality in the German church. The German church is collapsing except for its financial subsidy from the state. Why are we listening to people like that? They don't have anything to tell us. They're part of the problem. And then we have the cardinal from Chile, the retired cardinal from Chile, who's on the Pope's council, and he tried to cover up the sexual abuse thing in Chile. You know, so, wow, you know, we really need a cleansing from the top to the bottom, and I don't know what Francis is going to do. I don't know what he's thinking.
Well,
I don't know what he's thinking, having advisors like that.
I'm going to jump in now because we're almost out of time, and one of the things you recommend, and I think this is hugely important, is that we must pray. I mean, we must pray, and he needs to start questioning his closest advisors more than maybe he's doing, but we must pray for him.
Yeah.
We have 1 minute. Ralph, what more must we be doing?
Well, I think Our Lady of Fatima has told us so many important things. She said so many souls are going to hell because so few people are willing to pray and offer sacrifice for them. So I think we need to join to our prayer, sacrifice, fasting. But we also need to help our bishops do the right thing by making our views known. Lay people can't be passive anymore. If we see something wrong, we got to say something about it. We got to demand the proper accountability.
Absolutely.
I think it's time for lay people to stand up and ask for that.
Absolutely. Well, Ralph Martin, thank you for your service at Sacred Heart Seminary and teaching those seminarians, but also for the evangelizing work that you do. We are very grateful.
Thank you, Jeanette and Matthew, and thank you for the great role that Catholic Radio is doing in Catholic publications.
Thank you.
God bless.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Go to our podcast there to listen to this show and many more. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.